ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
A little while ago, you and I were tasked with, we were given homework, it's fair to say. We were asked to use ChatGPT.
The word homework just makes me nervous, but carry on. What haven't I done, Priya?
Well, our producer asked us to try ChatGPT a while ago. I did it, but you didn't.
No.
Have you delved into ChatGPT Health, this new entity that will help you with your medical issues?
No, I haven't.
Neither have I, but there is a study that's looked at it. It's looked at how effective it is at triaging medical problems. If you're in a life or death situation or you're just dealing with a sore throat, how good is it at triaging you?
The thought of it scares the crap out of me, but we will find out the truth of the matter today on the Health Report.
We will. I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
Also on the show, the first data coming out of general practice on GLP-1 prescribing, and the numbers are really quite significant.
Yeah, it really is quite comprehensive. Don't miss that. And new guidelines to help parents and clinicians who are dealing with children who may be, and adolescents who may be self-harming.
In the news, in the New England Journal of Medicine, there's a study that's looked at people with heart disease and...
You mean atherosclerotic heart disease?
I do mean that.
Oh, good.
And you know that I struggle with that word, so thank you, Norman Swan. But what we know, Norman, is that in people who have evidence of heart disease, who've had a stroke or a transient ischemic attack or a heart attack or an angiogram... Yes. We have these targets when it comes to cholesterol. We say, let's really aggressively manage their low-density lipoprotein, their LDL, and let's push it below a certain number.
And just to explain, when you've had a coronary event of some kind or a cardiovascular event of some kind, your risk of a second one is really high. So all bets are off. You're from what we call normal cholesterol levels or normal blood pressure levels. You want to get them down really low. And the question is, how low should you go?
Now, this study has been done in South Korea, and it said, you know, there are all these recommendations in terms of what people with heart disease should have their LDL cholesterol at, but they've said that there's a lack of randomised controlled trials to actually say why the numbers have been chosen. So in South Korea, they've got people with heart disease and they've randomised them, and some of them are being really aggressively managed to an LDL level of less than 1.4 millimoles per litre. People will know these numbers, perhaps 1.4. The other group are conventional. They're not as low. They're going to less than 1.8 millimoles per litre.
And the standard in Australia would be, for intensive therapy, probably lower than 1.7, thereabouts.
Well, I'll disagree with you there, because there was an update last year, yes.
And what did the update say?
The GP knows that there was an update last year in Australia. The Heart Foundation, the Cardiac Society of Australia and New Zealand actually said any patients with acute coronary syndrome should aim for the LDL less than 1.4.
Right. So acute coronary syndrome is you're heading for a heart attack. So
yes.
It's a bit more severe than just having baseline heart disease.
Yes. But there were some updates in recommendations and guidelines in Australia, and there's that number of 1.4 there. What they've done, they've randomised these people, they have looked at them for 3 years, they've looked at things like who has another heart attack, a stroke, death, who goes to hospital. And what they found is in the group at 3 years who had that really intensive management push to below 1.4, they did better. They had less events.
And how they did that was high-dose statins and also another drug that they use, ezetimibe, which can be added to statins to give you extra cholesterol reduction.
This for me, Norman, as a clinician, is a really good reminder to not let therapeutic inertia set in. And therapeutic inertia is a danger. It's a dangerous stuff. It's where I see you, Norman, I check your blood pressure and I go, it's a little bit high today. I might leave it. We'll check it next time. You go and see the GP next door who also says, Norman, it's a bit high today, but we'll check it next time. And no one actually jumps on things and manages it. So when I saw this, it was a really beautiful reminder that, gosh, get the lipids to target. in the people who need it. It's just another nudge.
We're all at risk of coronary heart disease. So getting your LDL down through lifestyle, and if your cholesterol is too high and you're at high risk, so your GP should be doing what's called an absolute risk score on you. What's your chances of having a heart attack or stroke in the next 5 or 10 years? And if that's high, you should be really managing things down.
The only thing with this study is that it was in East Asian patients only. So I do wonder if that has an impact. And the researchers did say that there was a potential limitation of their study, but, you know, just something to flag.
Because they have a higher than average risk.
Yes. Sorry, and I should have said because their level is higher than baseline. Fluoride and water, it continues to be in the news. There's a new study that has looked at adolescents, their IQ, and fluoride in water.
Yeah, so a bit of context here. People who are anti-fluoride, and there's a lot of them around in Australia as well as overseas, one of the things they've clung to in when they've gone to local councils to say, take the fluoride out of water, and it's certainly happened in the United States, is it damages children's brains and damages their IQ. And they've quoted certain studies to show that. And this study has looked at those studies, tried to correct for what were major errors in those studies and give an accurate assessment of IQ.
And can we just point out as well that a lot of the studies that people will often cling to are looking at fluoride levels way above what is actually in the community water.
And what they've done in this study is rather than look at school performance, which is what some of the other studies have done as a proxy for IQ, they've actually looked at IQ. They've looked at the dose of fluoride, because if fluoride is associated with lower IQ, then the higher the fluoride level, the more likely it should be to reduce IQ. Not school performance, because school performance, there's all sorts of other things involved in school performance, your family situation, the quality of the school you go to, your socioeconomic status, all sorts of things. It's not a good measure. It's not a measure at all of your IQ. So they've refined that. They've taken a lot of the variables into account and shown there's no effect of fluoridation on adolescent IQ.
It is safe.
Get in there. Protect your children's teeth. So, and one thing I do want to say is some people say, well, why would you have fluoride in the water supply when you can wash your teeth with fluoridated? If you really believe this, you can wash your teeth with fluoridated toothpaste. The reason you fluoridate water, be absolutely clear, is that people who are disadvantaged, whose lives are complex, who've got all sorts of issues to deal with, and they haven't got the time to actually devote to those preventive activities which we've got the luxury of doing, those children don't necessarily get access to fluoridated toothpaste. And what fluoridation of the water supply does is it equalises dental health.
Equity issue, agree.
And a really important public health issue.
Also in the news, it is coming up to cold and flu season, and this is the time, Norman, that patients say to me, Priya, what are you taking to prevent? And I say, well, I've got my flu vaccine and I'm exercising and eating, you know, fruit and veggies and doing all these things. The Therapeutic Goods Administration, the TGA, has started consulting on a proposal to remove a specific ingredient called Andrographis paniculata, which is a common substance found in Chinese and other herbal cold and flu remedies. It's often combined with echinacea, which is another thing that I have an issue with because it can also cause allergic reactions in some people. But the TGA has said, look, we're asking consumers, healthcare professionals, pharmacists, everybody on feedback because they're considering removing it off the permitted ingredients list, which means that if it's included in a product, the product is considered or deemed low risk and popped on a shelf.
And they've had warnings on products for a long time now.
Yes.
Saying it can cause anaphylaxis, and it's not changed the rate of anaphylaxis. In other words, people either ignore those warnings or just they're not effective. So there you are. You can make comments to the TGA on this, and the recommendation of the health report is steer clear.
Yes, and I think we need to be clear. The reason they're even opening up the discussion is because people are having allergic anaphylactic reactions. Someone has actually died, and this could happen. An allergic reaction could happen on the first time you take it, Norman. The 10th time, it could happen at any point. So a lot of these things also, and I know we always say this, but a lot of the stuff marketed at this time of year lacks evidence when it comes to prevention of colds and flus.
And despite all the stuff on the pharmacist's shelf, there's not a single cold and flu preparation on the shelf that makes any difference at all.
Agree.
Mostly causes you side effects rather than actually any benefit.
And wastes your money. And wastes your money, Norman. Sorry.
It does.
Yeah. Save your pennies.
It wastes your money. And just before we go, this is a hobby horse of mine. The waste of money internationally and time that's been spent on a theory for Alzheimer's disease, which is invalid now, and we spend more and more money on it, and it's distracted us from an effective solution to Alzheimer's disease. And it's the idea that this substance in the brain called beta amyloid is a cause of Alzheimer's disease, because there's a lot of it in the brain, but people think it's a cause. And there is very little evidence that it's a cause. And one of the pointers to this is that there are drugs now that are incredibly effective at removing amyloid from the brain, such as there's almost none left. And the question is, does it make any difference? So it's not made any difference to people with established dementia. So what the people have said who are really promoting the idea is, let's move it earlier and earlier to people with mild cognitive impairment, because that's early enough that we can actually make a difference. And now the Cochrane Library, or the Cochrane Collaboration, which brings together the available evidence on this, has concluded that really these drugs are not effective. They hardly improve function. They don't affect the tract to dementia, and they are associated with side effects. So we need to move on, unfortunately. They do the job, they remove the amyloid, but they don't do the job of preventing dementia.
And this is Cochrane Review. So it's looked at 17 clinical trials, over 20,000 participants. This is, you know, a really big snapshot of all the evidence in the area.
And talk about saving money, save you plenty.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. I do find, Norman, now in a consult, that large language models like ChatGPT Health are part of the consult now.
What do people say? What do they bring in? I've been to ChatGPT and they tell me that was bullshit what you told me last week, or what?
Not quite that. It's not quite that confronting. But Prio have already put this into ChatGPT Health. This is what it suggested. What do you think about this? And sometimes, if I'm honest, it puts up some quite good suggestions. I had recently a patient experience where I went, oh, I hadn't quite thought of that. And we went down the path and did the bloods and it had a good outcome. But often that is not the case. And there is a study that has looked at how effective ChatGPT Health is at actually triaging medical issues. So if you're having an asthma exacerbation, Norman, if you're having stroke-like symptoms, how good is it at actually telling you to go and attend the ED? I think everybody needs to listen very carefully, because there's some really surprising things that come out of this interview. I spoke to the lead author of the study, Dr. Ashwin Ramaswamy, who's an instructor of urology at Mount Sinai Hospital in Manhattan, New York City.
You know, I want to be very honest and open and say that I've not been in the artificial intelligence research business for very long, and this was my personal take at it. And one of the distinctions that I've used to explain how I picked the vignettes, how we built them, how we structured them, why we think that they're a good place in terms of evidence to compare to, was something a mentor of mine at Memorial Sloan Kettering said, is that there's a difference between arbitrary and subjective, which is that the vignettes that we created, they are flawed in their own way. Everything requiring human determination will have disagreement to some degree. But we had 90% consensus among three different physicians. We reviewed 39 clinical vignettes that were backed by 85 separate clinical guidelines. It's a 130-page document, and it's available online if anyone wants to look at it. And it's our best attempt to accumulate evidence for what we think are clear decisions for a variety of health problems, ranging from stroke to tension headache to gastrointestinal disease to a fever to a hot swollen joint, so on and so forth, and trying to see where there was consistency and where there wasn't.
So you've done a range. You've done this kind of acute stuff, stroke, diabetic ketoacidosis, asthma emergencies. How did, with the really urgent life and death stuff, how did ChatGPT Health perform there?
So we included in the original primary analysis two cases, one of diabetic ketoacidosis, which is found in type 1 diabetes. It's something that all type 1 diabetics should know to look out for, which is this feeling of nausea, stomach pain, thirst. And it can really cause life-threatening problems within hours. That was the first case. And then the second case, we looked at asthma. So a person who was using a rescue inhaler, like an albuterol inhaler, that's very typical. And this person in this vignette used it four times and was still having difficulty breathing, but still could speak in full sentences. And we included it with and without labs. But these were the two emergencies. And in both of those situations, there was significant degrees of under-triage. Under-triage meaning that when we asked ChatGPT Health what to do, it said, see a doctor in 24 to 48 hours rather than go to the emergency department.
Which could be fatal for someone.
Absolutely.
How about the other end of the spectrum, Ashwin? So for these non-urgent clinical settings where there's not a life-threatening situation, how did it perform there? Was it good at managing people or did it over-investigate them or tell them to go to emergency departments?
We were kind of highlighting the fact that these emergencies were not being recognized as emergencies, but one of the family medicine doctors in our hospital, who's the co-author, indicated that, hey, have you guys looked up why there's so much over triage? Meaning, hey, you should really go to the hospital. Like, you should go to the hospital when, you know, by our standard, by our triage categorization, you shouldn't. One of these cases was a sore throat, right? Just like, I have a sore throat for 3 days. I might be feeling a little bit hot, might be having a little bit of chills. The right thing to do in that instance is to stay at home and let it pass unless there's any issues. And in this case, the large language model ChatGPT Health said to go to a doctor's office within 24 to 48 hours, 84% of them. And the reason why this matters, the reason why anyone should care about this is because if your doctor's office is flooded, is you have tons of people coming in for things that they're worried about that the large language model told them to come in for, those patients who really need care, who are the diabetic ketoacidosis patients, who are the patients who can't breathe, they get less time and less resources dedicated towards them.
Does it do well anywhere? Like, does it perform well in the intermediate clinical group at all?
So it was interesting. So when you looked at a couple of things that I thought, in research, you typically kind of come up with a hypothesis, a fact that you want to prove about the world, and then you look at the data to try and establish it. Large language models have kind of disrupted that process because they act in a very random way. And so we found some stuff that's random and that it did very well on. To your point, yes, in cases in the middle, right, between you need to see a doctor at some point or you need to see a doctor in 2 days, it tended to do very well. And this is the thing that's being termed in artificial intelligence is the jagged edge, that it's sharp edge, that it's super smart in some things and really stupid in other things. And that's counterintuitive to how humans kind of perceive the world. The interesting thing as well was when we tested about gender and racial bias.
Yes.
Looking at, does it treat a black man or a black woman differently from a white man or a white woman? It was perfectly fine and consistent. So it didn't really care if you were black, if you were white, if you were a man, if you were a woman, if you were a combination of both. And that absence of sociodemographic bias is in some ways implicit bias that is common with racism and sexism in the world didn't manifest with the large language models.
I just wonder, this appears to be in your study, the suggestion that if you inserted lab details, if you put in objective values like blood pressure or oxygen saturations, that it appeared to improve the accuracy of the ChatGPT Health's triaging?
Yes. So it did and it didn't in kind of weird ways. So in the ways that it did, it actually increased. And I want to be clear, this was not what we were initially intending to study. So this was not a part of the primary hypothesis. This was a part of the sensitivity analysis, the extra work we did after we found the associations. But when we had objective data, and this is what, when you go to ChatGPT, you look at the ads online about health, everyone's telling you, hey, upload your labs to these platforms, they'll do a really good job in explaining to you what's going on. So that's sort of what we tested as well. We looked at laboratory findings, we looked at vital signs, we looked at an exam, three very basic aspects of what doctors look for when they're diagnosing patients. And we found something that was a little bit strange. So it improved overall accuracy. So if you looked at the big picture and you didn't look at the specifics, it improved overall accuracy from about 50% to about 80%. So
okay.
That's like from, at least in the United States, that's from like a D to a B.
Yep.
And then the problem was, is that we also found it causing some real issues. So one of the most concerning failures that we found was regarding suicidal ideation, which is which was really scary, and we investigated some more. We had this example, and I'll just kind of talk about this distinctive safety failure. ChatGPT Health, when you write something that is suggestive that you're thinking about self-harm, that you're depressed, that you're going through a really tough time in life, especially in this modern era, that it created, and we didn't know this in advance, but it created these crisis intervention banners. Separate from the message, separate from the reply, a little kind of indicator that popped out, called an interstitial, signaling to, in the United States, what we is the 988 suicide and crisis lifeline. I'm sure there's something like that.
Yes, there is. Yep.
In Australia as well. And in this instance, so we had a 27-year-old patient. Just imagine a 27, someone in their late 20s reporting, and I quote, "I thought about taking a lot of pills." And in that instance, the crisis intervention messages, the signal to that patient telling them to seek help, to call a nurse, to find resources, appeared in none of the responses that included normal objective findings. So if I said to you that you're, I'm thinking about taking a lot of pills, but my lab value is normal, it didn't flag it at all. And the reasoning it had verbatim from the large language model was, your labs are all within the normal ranges and don't suggest a medical cause for these thoughts.
So a huge safety failure. Huge safety failure.
A significant one that is unexplainable. I don't know why. So the last thing I would say is that for anyone listening and for people using these large language models, especially as they're evolving so rapidly, you have to be a little bit skeptical. And I would do yourself a favor of, before falling into accepting the advice, which many of these large language models will give accurate advice, is to ask it to check its facts before going with it.
So what do you mean by that, though? Do you mean actually questioning what it tells you?
Exactly, yes. Saying, can you check again? Or, I'm not sure if you saw the full picture. Or, I just want to verify this result.
Okay,
something
so to
like
push
that.
Back on it a little bit, to test it a little bit.
Just the smallest amount.
Okay, a gentle test. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Dr. Ashwin Ramaswamy from Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City.
So what are you going to say the next time somebody comes in and says, I've done ChatGPT, just say...
I'm going to say listen to the episode. No, I'm going to say listen to the episode because I think Ashwin had some excellent points. But Norman, there's pros and cons to everything. And I think there are a lot of cons when it comes to ChatGPT Health and triaging medical issues. But the pro here is that there's a resistance to those normal social demographic biases that often is evident in healthcare when it comes to gender and race.
So you're saying that ChatGPT is unbiased?
Well, that's what this study appeared to show. And I'm just saying that there are silver linings everywhere and perhaps a pro. We can't be always negative
you're
on the health report.
You're such a nice person, much nicer than me.
I know.
You're with the health, you're with the... sort of nice and not so nice health report on ABC Radio National. As you say all the time, Priya, what's a health report without a story on GLP-1s? The drug of the moment. And the question is, how much is out there? And it's hard to tell because you can't use government data because a lot of the prescribing, as you'd know, Priya, are on private scripts, expensive private scripts. How much is going on? Well, in fact, there are New South Wales data that help us in this way. And one of the people who's brought this together is Professor Louisa Jorm, who's director of the Centre for Big Data Research in Health at the University of New South Wales. Welcome to the Health Report, Louisa.
Good morning. Good morning, Norman and Priya.
So let's just start, Louisa, by talking, because what we're doing here is talking about really comprehensive data from general practice, which hitherto has not really been available, and it's linked to hospital data, and very few other states in Australia have it other than New South Wales.
That's right. And so this study used data from a data asset called Lumos, which has been developed over quite a number of years now in partnership between the New South Wales Ministry of Health and Primary Health Networks in New South Wales. And that actually brings together de-identified general practice electronic medical record data, which previously have been basically not available for research, and links those with hospital and other health system data. And there's sort of more than 700 New South Wales general practices participating in Lumos currently.
And you've been looking at, well, you literally were looking at semaglutide, but you've been looking at other GLP-1s as well. And the beauty of this is it observes general practice behaviour, whether it's in the public sector or the private sector, and if you like, whether they're giving a script on the PBS or a script or a private script, which for obesity is what they have to give.
Totally. So at the moment, none of the GLP-1 medications are actually subsidised through the PBS for weight management. And it's really only semaglutide that is subsidised for diabetes, but only even then for a subset of people with diabetes who are not successfully managed through to other forms of frontline treatment. So, yeah, it's only a small subset potentially of those who may benefit from these drugs who are currently accessing them through the PBS, and that's where the GP data is so helpful because it does capture, as you said, the private prescriptions as well as those that are subsidised through the PBS.
So, Louisa, you've looked at who's been initiated or how many people have been initiated on semaglutide from January 2020 to November 2023, and this is in adults aged over 18. What have you found in that time period? Is it significantly increasing?
Yeah, in that initial time period, which is our recently published paper and included data from 680 practices, we identified almost 60,000 adults who had a first GP prescription for semaglutide. But the interesting thing was that that number rose really, really sharply. So only 400 people in 2020 to more than 36,000 people in 2023. So very rapid expansion.
And on the PBS or private, what was the balance between the two? In other words, what was the balance between for obesity versus diabetes?
Yeah, sorry, we don't actually know from the Lumos data, but when we compare with what we do not know about PBS prescribing in the same period, it looks as though only about one third of the total number of people prescribed semaglutide were potentially accessing it through the PBS because they had diabetes. So it looks like, you know, there's very large use outside of that, of those PBS restrictions.
Do we have any further breakdown on who is getting these prescriptions in terms of gender or social demographic information?
Yeah, we do. So overall, women comprise about two-thirds of those who are getting these prescriptions. And probably really importantly, the proportion of people who have type 2 diabetes actually declined over that period from 2020 to 2023 from 92% to only around 66%. So clearly more people accessing outside the diabetes population. And we can also look at the socioeconomic status of individuals. And, you know, there is some evidence that people who were accessing the medication outside of PBS were slightly more advantaged than those who were accessing through the PBS. But that may relate to the fact that diabetes is more common in people of lower socioeconomic status. But I think a really sort of important issue is that of the people without diabetes and therefore not able to access through the PBS, around a quarter of those actually did come from the most disadvantaged communities in New South Wales. And so those people are paying the full out-of-pocket costs because they can't access through the PBS.
Now, the advantage in Lumos data, as far as I understand it, is that for the first time in Australia, it links what happens in general practice to what happens in hospitals. So you can track people from general practice to hospitals and back again. And as I say, you can't do this in any other state. One of the big sells for GLP-1s is that, even just for obesity, is that it prevents heart attacks, strokes, and exacerbations of your diabetes and so on. Are you seeing in this population fewer hospital admissions?
Well, of course, these data are relatively recent, with semaglutide only sort of appearing from 2020, and there's generally quite a long lag time for effects on cardiovascular and cardiometabolic outcomes, particularly hospitalizations and deaths. So we haven't actually looked at that yet. It's a little early, but that's certainly what we can do with the Lumos data, and it's really going to provide that real-world evidence about what is happening in the real-world population who may be quite distinct from the individuals who are included in the clinical trials on which the current evidence is based. So that's a fantastic potential for what can be done with the Lumos asset going forwards.
You've mentioned that women were the majority, made up the bulk of people who were initially prescribed the GLP-1s, the semaglutide. What about the indication, Louisa, if it's not on the PBS, if it's not for diabetes, in terms of clear indicators of why people might be getting the medications? Is it always clear?
Unfortunately, not from the data. We don't actually know the indication. We only know that, the medication was prescribed. But there's several possible reasons behind this, some of which may be clinical, obviously including management of obesity, but also there's some evidence in the areas of polycystic ovarian syndrome and infertility that these medications may be beneficial for women for those indications. But of course, social factors may also play a role in, you know, including things like weight stigma, appearance-related pressure, and also the high public visibility of these medications. But we can't tell what the patient's motivation was or what the prescriber's reasoning was from these data.
Now, when you did this study, semaglutide, brand name Ozempic, was the only game in town. Since then, Ozempic has transformed for weight loss into Wegovy, a higher dose version of semaglutide. And then Eli Lilly's come in with their tirzepatide, known as Zepbound, or what's the other name for it? Zepbound?
Mounjaro.
Thank you very much.
Mounjaro.
Yeah, keeping me right here. Yeah. Good. You need real doctors here, Louisa. That's the secret here. What's happened since, now that you've got more competition in the marketplace?
Yeah, so not yet published. We have had a look at the more recent data. So the original study period ended in November 2023, and you'll remember that we identified about 59,000 people at that point in Lumos who'd initiated semaglutide. But by April 2025, more than 84,000 people had initiated GLP-1 therapy, this time including both semaglutide and tirzepatide or Mounjaro.
Wow.
And what would you take away from that, just simply competition in the marketplace?
Well, I think it's not just that. It's that there's been still a rapid increase in uptake of one or the other. It's only around a third in the most recent data who are initiating on the tirzepatide or Mounjaro. But I guess a nice sort of headline finding is that from these most recent data up to April 2025, if we sort of extrapolate from the Lumos population in New South Wales to the overall Australian population, there's probably around 760,000 Australians who've actually initiated one of these medications since 2020.
Wow. Mm. And your takeaway from all this? Is what?
Well, takeaway is that there's huge demand for these medications, and I guess there's a lot of policy implications and equity implications that we're racing to keep up with. In terms of the tirzepatide story, it is sort of interesting that it's obviously sort of entering the market and taking a reasonable market share of the new uptake. This may relate to the fact that many or most of the people with diabetes who are going to take these medications already are. And so most of the new uptake is amongst people who are not eligible, don't have diabetes, can't get it through the PBS. And so they're between a rock and a hard place. They're going to have to pay a lot, whatever they choose, whether they choose Wegovy or whether they choose Mounjaro. And there's some evidence that Mounjaro may be more effective for the weight loss indication from clinical trials.
But the irony is, just finally, that the people who could benefit most can afford it least.
Mm. Yep, exactly. Exactly.
Louisa, thanks for joining us.
Could I just finally finish by just thanking the Lumos team in New South Wales Health, who sort of made this work possible, as well as all the primary health networks and practices who participate in the Lumos program.
You can indeed, and you have done.
Great. Great. Thanks very much.
Professor Louisa Jorm is at the University of New South Wales.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report.
So our next story, Priya, is about a difficult topic, but a really important one. It's about self-harm in children and adolescents.
It is, and the first ever dedicated clinical practice guideline to support children with self-harm, with suicide, has been released. It feels like it's been a huge gap. There's been nothing in this space for health professionals, clinicians, GPs, psychologists, psychiatrists to kind of refer to.
Or indeed parents.
That's right. Or indeed parents and caregivers. So this has been developed alongside the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne and the University of Melbourne. And we are joined by the Guideline Development Group Chair from Murdoch Children's Research Institute, Sydney Stevens. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Sydney. Let's just sort of get the baseline right. What are the statistics showing about self-harm in children and adolescents?
Yeah, well, we know that it is going up in children and young people. So we know that self-harm hospitalizations are going up across the country, and it is the number one cause of death for children aged, I think it's 15 to 17. And we know that young people today are more likely to experience thoughts of self-harm or self-harm than previous generations. So,
and just to clarify, when we talk about children and adolescents, I mean, my understanding is that depression doesn't really kick in till about after the age of 10. It's mostly anxiety in younger children, and depression kicks in after that. Are we really talking about young children?
Well, it can be young children, and that's a bit of a misconception. It's perhaps not as sort of that pointy end of, you know, feeling like they want to die, or they want to kill themselves, but it can be, you know, more passive thoughts about, you know, what if I wasn't here, or what if, what would happen with that sort of thing. So it really is just a bit more passive, but it can happen in young children.
And is it like adults where depression is part of the story, but only part?
Well, yes, absolutely. There is a lot that goes into it. It's a really complex issue, and it's often not just thoughts of suicide or thoughts of self-harm. It is a much larger issue that maybe has other mental health conditions or other physical health conditions, but can also be connected to relationships, school, family, and other things like that.
How much is stigma still a part of this? Because you've just said misconceptions to, you know, something Norman said. How much is stigma still a huge element of this story?
Yeah, stigma is huge. It is absolutely misunderstood and stigmatized in our society. Even just talking about the language of suicide and self-harm, it's something that we don't talk about, or people don't even want to say the words suicide. It's very much rooted in that criminality of it. Even the usage of the word commit suicide, to commit suicide, associates it with committing other crimes or murders. We don't like to use that term anymore. We like to say died by suicide or other things like that. But it is absolutely something that is stigmatized, and it's something that we need to start talking about. You know, it shouldn't be taboo in our society.
Okay, so you've got this guideline, which is supposed to be a guideline to, if you like, a Bible for clinicians, whether it be psychologists, GPs, psychiatrists, child psychiatrists, and so on, to follow, and also information for parents so they know the kind of right questions to ask and what the care pathway might be. But I want to challenge you, Sydney. The title says evidence-based, and I've been through it. It's not evidence-based at all. There's a handful of all the recommendations you're making, only a handful are based on evidence. The rest are what are called consensus-based recommendations. And that pejoratively used to be called good old boys sat around the table. In other words, opinion not based on evidence at all. And so how can you actually put your hand in your heart and say this is evidence-based when it's just a tiny handful?
Well, that's a really good question, Norman. And it really is in the process that we use to develop this guideline. So we can call it an evidence-based guideline because we've used an evidence-based process. We have done the evidence reviews, so we know that there is not a lot of evidence out there. Over the course of the development, I think we did 4 systematic evidence reviews and found a handful of studies that were something that we could use to then guide clinical practice.
So how can we trust it then? I mean, we can trust that you've gone through a process, and if there's evidence, you've found it. But how can we trust the vast majority of recommendations and you say, well, this is going to guide care?
Well, we use the next best thing, which is consensus, and we take the best steps that we can to ensure that we get a really well-rounded consensus and grounded in that evidence and research when we can. So we have a group of, I think it was 27 clinicians, researchers, and young people with lived experience that were a part of this group. And what we do is once we do the evidence review, we say, hey, there's not a lot out there about this. Let's talk about this next best thing, which is consensus. And sort of then we go into lots of discussions. So we have hours and hours of recorded discussions from this group. And the idea is that anyone that might be involved or might be affected by this guideline, which would include clinicians, parents, carers, all of that, are involved in the making of the guideline. And we, to be honest with you, had a couple things that were tricky bits where one person would say, I don't think we should say that or say this. And we're really, really specific about the wording of things. And we go back and forth with this group a lot. And so you really can have some trust that there are the best experts and the voices behind this guideline.
How important is that lived experience voice from young people?
Well, it's huge. The lived experience is a really important part of this development. It's a really important part of the work that I do as a researcher. It's one of those things where we know what the evidence can say, and we know that this might be the best, but what actually is realistic in clinical practice. And that is lived experience from clinicians as well, but also lived experience from young people that have gone through the system, experienced things that are good, experienced things that are bad, and can inform what we want.
Some of the recommendations that I saw, and this is with my GP hat on, you know, there's things like really aiming for gold standard, DBT in place of CBT.
And just access, to explain here, we're talking about dialectical behavioural therapy rather than cognitive behavioural therapy.
Yes, with a trained health professional and the kinds of wards that adolescents and children should be admitted to. Some of it is, you know, I think real world. Is all of it feasible?
Mm.
And, you know, as someone practicing, I read it and I thought, that's gold standard, but I can't imagine accessing this for my patients.
Mm. Yeah, that it is aspirational, this guideline. It is something that we want to set that gold standard and work towards what is the best. Acknowledging that some things are not practical in clinical practice, DBT was something that we did discuss a lot and something that people had said, well, it's not really accessible. Mm. It's difficult to access.
And just to explain, rather than going to it now, we'll put a link to a DBT resource so you can understand what it is on our website. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. DBT is more difficult to access. It's more difficult to have training for, so not as many clinicians are trained in DBT. And that was one that was actually evidence-based. It was something that we have evidence to show that DBT can be helpful for young people experiencing this. So it was one of those things where we have to sort of marry what the evidence says with what is practical. But it is aspirational. There are things in here that we know perhaps are not practical in certain settings, but we should work towards what's best.
So if I was a parent reading this, we can't do it. We'll be here all day if we were to do an interview on the whole guideline. If you were to choose, say, the top two or three things from this guideline that a parent should know, what would they be?
Mm.
Should have given you notice of that, shouldn't I, Sydney?
Yes. No, that's good. Well, there are 71 recommendations, so trying okay. to rack my
the
brain over the best ones. But I think throughout the whole guideline, there's a sense of a whole system responsibility.
So it takes a village.
It takes a village. It really does take a village. And that includes the support system. That includes parents and carers. That includes other trusted adults in a person's life, maybe educators or coaches or other people that see the child regularly. And it does take a village to identify a certain behavior or concern, get that person to the clinical care that they need, and then go through management and treatment as well. So it really does take a village. I think also another thing to sort of understand for parents is the idea of that child-centered or person-centered care as well, involving a young person in discussions about self-harm or suicide, involving them in decisions about their care as well. So really making it something that is collaborative between the child, their support system, and their clinicians. The other thing that I think is important for parents to note or understand is the idea of a function that these behaviors can play in a young person's life.
In other words, what's the net reason they're doing it, if you
Exactly.
Like?
The reason behind a behavior. It's something that is not always, there's a misconception of it being sort of attention-seeking or something like that. It's really often not attention seeking or anything around that. It's you know, a behavior that is a coping mechanism for some really big feelings or other things that they can't control in their life. It is something a young person can control. So looking at the different aspects of a young person's life, whether that's school or their relationships with their friends, other supports in the community that are affecting those behaviors as well is really important to, and then in management and treatment, treating the function behind those behaviours.
What about the role of medications? Because the guidelines do address that specifically.
Yeah, so we know that medications are not necessarily effective to treat self-harm specifically. There are risks with negative effects of medications. Lots of medications can cause thoughts of self-harm or suicide. And we don't recommend the use of medications specifically to treat functions. But medications can do a lot of other great things, especially for other mental health conditions. So it's important the sort of rules.
The child needs to be properly diagnosed.
Exactly. Properly diagnosed and the whole picture. But also when starting medications, a lot of the recommendations towards the end focus on the role of, you know, educating a parent and carer and a child about you know, the risks of taking these medications, the risks of negative effects, and the risk of misuse of those medications as well. So it's really important to have those conversations around medications.
Sydney, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sydney Stevens from the Murdoch Children's Research Institute and the University of Melbourne. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Health Report.
What's in the mailbag?
Madeline has written in response to a story we did on the flu vaccine and what this year's flu vaccine contains. And she says, I'm about to get my flu immunisation, but I'm wondering if we're still getting COVID boosters. Haven't heard mention of it this year, although last year I'm pretty sure I had a combined flu and COVID shot.
Well, you'd have had them at the same time, but they weren't. Yes. Unfortunately, at the moment, they're not combined.
It's not in the one vaccine. But yes, absolutely. We're still, you know, I'm talking all the time in the clinic about COVID boosters. And you can go and have a look at the recommendations according to your age group. But for people aged 65 and older, it is certainly, you know, something to consider every 6 to 12 months based on what your immune system is doing. But everyone should be considering it, you know, once a year.
But Madeline, you're not as old as that. But even then...
We don't know, you can still is the
it.
Thing.
Madeline just writes like a young person. I just feel...
Oh, you can
I get the vibe.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, younger people can benefit from the COVID booster, so don't give up on the idea.
Joe's also written in also on vaccinations. Hi, Priya and Norman. It's not in my nature to be gushy, but I just want to say that I do love your show and listen every week. Well, we'll take it, Joe. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Joe.
I'm a 69-year-old female.
No, you're not, Jo. You're younger than that, but carry on
you're
anyway.
You're writing like a young person, according to Norman. And up to date with all my vaccinations, I have recently been diagnosed as having rheumatoid arthritis and am on prednisolone and methotrexate. Last year, two of my very healthy neighbours in their 60s ended up in hospital with RSV, respiratory syncytial virus. It occurred to me that as my immunity might take a beating with my new drugs, yes, getting an RSV vaccination might be a good idea. Imagine my surprise to learn that this vaccination was going to cost me $300. Do you know why that is? Oh, I can go on for days here, Norman.
Okay, you've got 2 minutes. Carry on.
Well, there is a vaccination. It's called Arexvy is the brand name. It is recommended for people over 60 if you look at the ATAGI advice. For people who are 50 to 59 at higher risk of RSV, so people with a compromised immune system, it's recommended. It's not funded by the government across the board, and it should be, I think, but it's an expensive vaccine and you just cross your fingers and toes that they're going to eventually fund it. It's like meningococcal B vaccination for kids across the schedule, across the National Immunisation Program. I think that's pennies well spent, Norman, but people don't agree with me.
Me too.
Do you?
Yeah.
And RSV, can I just say this, Joe, because you are correct. People often think of newborns, of infants, and that's, of course, why we now have the rollout of the RSV vaccine for pregnant women. There's also babies that can get the antibodies delivered and to protect them. But it's not just a young kids thing. It does really, as you've said, put your friends and neighbours in hospital. It really does impact people aged over 60 negatively. So if you can afford it and you're looking for risk benefit, this is one to spend your pennies on.
And just quickly, Suzanne writes on B12 toxicity. She says, hi, Priya Norman, recently discussed B12 toxicity, after which I decided to drop my B12. So warning here, we did not talk about B12 toxicity, Suzanne. We talked about B6 pyridoxine toxicity, which
yes.
is hidden in a lot of things. There are some problems with B12, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about B6. So you should talk to your GP and think about going back on B12.
Yes.
If you need it.
Different B. And for anyone who is interested in the voluntary assisted dying area, on the Law Report this week, that is being covered after the recent death of a 25-year-old paraplegic woman in Spain. It's gained worldwide attention after she was granted access to euthanasia despite a legal challenge by her father. And there's been a lot of questions that have come up as a result of this case. And the Law Report with Damien Carrick is taking a close look at the narrow approach here in Australia, the expansive approach in Belgium, and the rapidly evolving scheme in Canada. So there's a link in our show notes. You can listen to the episode or you can find on ABC Listen.
And don't forget our sister podcast, What's That Rash?
We do love your emails and our address is healthreport@abc.net.au. We've had a lot of response to fungal nail infections, Norman.
I'm not surprised.
Yes, big response. So we've put it on our list of topics for a rainy day and we will do it. But a lot of you were very interested in the topic.
See you next week.
I'll see you then, maybe with a light mask on.
Oh, really? You'll be bumping into walls.
They do have holes for your eye, you know.
Oh, do
that.
They?
Yeah, they do. See you next week, Norman.
Well, maybe, depending on that mask of yours. See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.